This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The fight continues in Washington over President Trump's proposed border wall and the national emergency he declared to secure funding to build it. But the border wall is only one element of a prolonged battle and debate over immigration in this country, both legal and illegal.
Another issue that is yet to be settled is the fate of people in the country legally with DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals status. The future of DACA, along with immigration policies that have separated families, will be the focus of a forum this weekend organized by the League of Women Voters. Ed Falone is an associate professor of law at Marquette University and a member of the Undocumented Students Task Force at that school.
He'll be on the panel on Saturday, but spoke ahead of time with Lake Effect's Bonnie North. He says the issue of legal immigration is sometimes overlooked in the public debate.
Oftentimes, it's about not blaming immigrants for failing to do something the law doesn't permit them to do, and by the same token, not punishing or criticizing immigrants for doing exactly what the law allows them to do. So it really does require an understanding of our system. Basically, legal immigration falls into four broad categories. Most legal immigration to our country is based on a family relationship to a U.S. citizen, someone already here, in some cases a permanent resident already here. But it's a nuclear family. We're not talking cousins. We're not talking aunts and uncles. We're talking about parents, spouse, children.
Not even grandparents.
The second category of legal immigration is employment-based, based on particular skills. Usually it's an advanced education. We're talking about people with advanced college degrees, master's, PhD, or specialized job skills where there's an employer in the U.S. who has a job. They can't find qualified U.S. workers. Significantly, what is not included is unskilled labor. People who don't have a high school degree, much less a college degree, people who don't have specialized skills, all they want to do is come to the United States and work hard. Oftentimes people say, get in line, apply for a visa. Well, there's no line. There's at most, technically, you could argue 5,000 visas available a year for unskilled labor. The waiting list for that is so long, you're talking 30 years before you even had a chance. So realistically, that lane is closed. Then you've got refugees and political asylees, and these are individuals who have a well-founded fear of persecution, and they're fleeing for their lives, really. But they only are qualified if in somewhat narrow category if the reason for their persecution is based on race, religion, nationality, their political opinion, or their membership in a particular social group. And that's where there is some uncertainty in the law, whether, for example, women who are abused in domestic violence situations where the local police won't help them, whether they qualify as falling in a social group, or whether women in general who face violence in their home country where they're not protected, whether that qualifies as a social group. So there's a little uncertainty in the law there. And then the fourth category is we have this crazy lottery system where if you're from a country of low immigration, typically Northern Europe or Africa, then you can apply for a lottery and we take about 50,000 a year that way. All told, somewhere around a million hundred thousand a year come in through one of those four categories. The people at the border don't have the option of asking to come in as unskilled labor. That's not available. And they're trying to come in as a refugee and political asylee. And that is an opportunity under the law, and they'd like to try and make that case.
So are there quotas? I mean, I know in the past there certainly have been, whether they were official or not, mm-hmm. I'm not sure. But, you know, certain groups were more welcome than others.
Well, we do have quotas, and we have two kinds of quotas still. One is based on the category, so only a certain number of adult sons and daughters of U.S. citizens can immigrate every year. So there's an overall cap on that number, which means if you're in that category, there's far more people applying for those visas than there are visas available. You may have to wait a couple years. There's also a second cap, which is a per country cap. And so there are some countries where there's a huge number of adult sons and daughters of U.S. citizens, the Philippines, India. And in those countries, because of the country cap, that's an additional limit to prevent them from scooping up all the available. So the weight in those countries, for example, the Philippines and some of the family categories, the wait can be 20 years. And that's what happens. Now, where there is no wait is political asylum. If you are present in the U.S., the statute says you can make a claim, and there's no limit on the number of people. We've been running around 100,000, 120,000 a year in that category, but there's theoretically no upper limit on that.
So refugees from, say, Syria, they could come here and apply. Any number could apply.
Yeah. If they get here, any number can apply. If they're in an overseas refugee camp, there's a vetting process. It's very lengthy. The State Department's involved, the United Nations Committee on Refugees, and there's an application process. And so that people who are displaced and in an overseas refugee camp, they get kind of matched up with a particular country, a particular community, where there might be, for example, a Syrian community in part of the U.S., and they get brought to the U.S. But that's a separate system. If you get to the U.S. on your own and you claim political asylum, then presumably you have a right to appear before an immigration judge and to argue that you have a fear of persecution based on one of these five categories. And if the immigration judge agrees with you, then you get a grant of political asylum and you're entitled to stay, move on to get a green card, and eventually be a citizen.
So what is happening at our border with Mexico? There are a lot of people who are coming to the border who are claiming exactly that. They're claiming refugee mm-hmm. status. They're claiming political asylum status. What seems to be happening there that seems to be such a political touch point going on that's different from, say, people coming from Africa maybe claiming the same thing?
Well, the situation has changed a little bit, the facts on the ground. You've got many countries in Central and South America where the rule of law has really broken down, and you've got armed gangs that forcibly recruit young children. And so parents initially were sending their children on their own to the U.S. just to get them out of that situation under the argument that their life was in danger because this armed gang that the government couldn't control would kill them if they remained and didn't join the gang. So the first part of this crisis was children arriving unaccompanied. And initially, under the Obama administration, there was some attempt to keep them in detention, but there was litigation and there's a court settlement where the government has agreed not to keep children on their own. There was also then you began to get families come together with small children fleeing this situation. And the question is, well, what do you do? Do you put the entire family in detention together? Do you keep the adults and allow the children to be placed with relatives or friends in the U.S.? Do you let the parents out? And I think what has changed now in the current situation is we have this phenomenon of the caravans where people in Central and South America have come to realize it's far safer to undertake the journey on foot in a group. Previously, being on your own, getting food, being safe from violence or robbers, exploitation, it was very dangerous to move on your own. And so what's happened is that they've now started to come in groups for safety's sake and have better access to food, medical care, et cetera. It made sense. But now they're coming in a large group. Theoretically, they should be able to present at the border and ask for political asylum. The Trump administration policies, we don't want to hear these cases. How do we deter them from asking for what the law provides? There's simply more people asking than we can handle. We don't have enough immigration judges. We could theoretically give them a court date and release them into the community and say, come back for your court date. The Trump administration doesn't want to do that. And they really, I think, have a policy of separating the families, making the situation of asking for political asylum so traumatic that they're hoping the word will get back to Central and South America, don't come to the U.S. It's horrible. And so they're really trying to use this family separation policy as a way of deterring people from making political asylum claims that under the law, if they arrive at the U.S. border, they have a right to make that claim. The law gives them a right that the Trump administration would prefer they not exercise.
Is this kind of deterrence happening with other groups, or is it specifically focused on Central and South America?
Well, I think that's an interesting question, and I think that if you talk to lawyers who practice in immigration law, they will tell you that every kind of visa from tourist visas to student visas. I had a conversation with an immigration lawyer recently about a fiancé visa. A U.S. citizen wanted to bring his fiancé to the U.S. to get married here. Every kind of immigration visa, it seems the Trump administration is slow walking and trying to question and put obstacles into it. And I think that that's a very consistent strategy. Rather than try to change the law, which would require getting a bipartisan consensus in Congress, instead use the application of the law, which the executive branch controls, as a way of creating a different reality. And to be honest, people on the right of the political spectrum accused the Obama administration of doing the same thing when it came to choosing not to deport certain groups. And in fact, the DACA program, the Deferred Action Childhood Arriver or Dreamer situation, is really an example of the executive branch choosing not to enforce deportation against a segment that under the law theoretically should be deported. The Trump administration right now is doing the inverse, aggressively enforcing the law in a way to achieve their goals. The law stays the same, but the facts on the ground change depending on the enforcement priorities.
Have there been historical precedents for both ignoring deportation and allowing people to stay who probably shouldn't, and also throwing up the roadblocks that we're seeing? I mean, have there been times in our history where these things have happened?
Yes, again, that's a good point, and I think the general public should recognize. In terms of not deporting individuals who technically have no right to remain, there have been many times over our U.S. history where, for example, people fleeing a natural disaster or a humanitarian crisis have been permitted to remain in the U.S. even though they had no lawful claim. Probably the largest group was after the Tiananmen Square uprising in China. We had a large number of Chinese students in the United States who all of a sudden their student visa expired, and it was felt they would not be safe if they went back to China, but they had no real evidence of fear. They've been in the U.S. for a while. There was no evidence they would be mistreated, but there was a general concern. And under the first President Bush, he issued an executive order allowing them to stay in the U.S. even though their student visas had expired. And eventually Congress came around and created visas for them to allow them to stay permanently. But that was another situation of a humanitarian situation where the executive branch said, you know, we're not going to deport you even though we could. And really the DACA program is similar in that way. It's the idea is that you have a segment of the undocumented population, about 800,000 individuals, who were brought to the U.S. by their parents when they were young children, and they have no right to remain here. But there's nothing in the law that allows an undocumented person in the U.S. to become lawful. There's no mechanism for that. You can't go from undocumented to lawful. And so they remain in the U.S. with no possibility of legalizing their status. That means that they can't work legally for an employer. It means that it's very difficult for them to own property because they can't buy a house if you're going to get deported and lose it. Their ability to pursue higher education is very limited because as non-citizens, they can't qualify in many states for in-state tuition or even federal financial assistance.
Technically, they're not there.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. So and this is really a population where their presence here, the median age for most of them when they were brought to the U.S. by their parents is 6 years old. They didn't participate in that decision. They're here. They're living their life. They many times have no memory of the home country where they were born. And in that case, there really is a humanitarian argument. It makes no sense to try and deport these people. And so that's what the DACA executive decision by the Obama administration was designed to do. There had been many attempts to resolve this with a bill in Congress, but it always got wrapped up with broader immigration reform. There was always some other issue. We still see this today. The wall question gets wrapped up with other immigration issues. This is an issue that for some reason Congress for the last 20 years, going on 30 years, has been unable to fix the law. And finally, President Obama said, well, we just will choose not to deport these people.
Looking at the other side where you were talking about the current administration throwing up roadblocks, slowing the process down for all legal immigration or visas or whatever.
Yeah.
What's the historical precedent for that? Has this happened in the past also?
There have been instances more prior to our existing statutes under older regimes. But for example, during the Cold War, if you had someone who technically qualified for a visa but was coming from the Eastern Bloc, a communist nation, oftentimes you would find this sort of slow walking of the entry and sort of summary denials for obscure reasons, even though they were qualified under the statute. That's a little bit further in the past. And I think it really has been striking under the current administration. Certainly in recent decades, if the statute says your client is permitted to come to the U.S., your client qualifies, I think most immigration lawyers have always assumed then their client would get in. And this is sort of a new world. But again, if the Trump administration can't achieve its policy goals by convincing Congress to rewrite the law, the way they enforce it becomes a tool that they can use.
Just like the Obama administration, just like the Bush 1 administration.
Yes, I think so. I think this is a little bit different because it's one thing to stretch what the statute allows out of a humanitarian concern. It's quite a different thing, in my opinion, to use your executive power to try and punish or be punitive to people. And so the motivation certainly is not humanitarian. The motivation is we want you to not come because we want to send a message. And I think that's a big difference between the two situations.
This whole conversation has me thinking about our overall attitudes towards immigration and the fact that we are an immigrant country. We're a country of immigrants. I mean, I know where all of my people came from, and they did not come from the United States. Yeah. It's been a few generations back, probably the same for you. Have we always had such a difficulty wrestling with this idea of allowing new people to come in to where we came in maybe 50 or 100 years ago or more?
Unfortunately, I think that's true in our nation. And one of the panelists at the March 2nd event at Overno College is Rachel Ida Buff, who's an immigration historian who can speak very eloquently on this history. We as a nation have consistently tried to demonize different immigrant groups. And I actually think that the situation of the Dreamers is really eye-opening for many people, because here you have a segment of immigrants who are not U.S. citizens, they're undocumented, and yet really they're functionally identical to any other young person that I've ever met. I mean, they go to the same schools, they listen to the same music, they have the same social activities, they speak predominantly English, they have low crime rates, they have big dreams, they want to go to college, they want to pursue professional careers and contribute to society. They're very idealistic. To me, I look at them and I say, what's the difference between them and my own children who are born in this country? I see no difference. But yet in our rhetoric and in politics, you know, our leaders sometimes try to demonize immigrants and suggest they're very different. They're not like us. And whether you cast them as criminals or freeloaders or something, it's really just an attempt to deny their basic humanity.
It just seems to me that we have such an interesting relationship with the idea of immigration. I don't think anyone disagrees that a country has a right to its borders and to allow who they want in. But we also seem to never quite settle for ourselves what that means. Are we the Emma Lazarus, you know, the Statue of Liberty?
You're tired, you're poor.
You're yearning to breathe free.
There you go.
Yes, that one. Or, okay, no, we're full, and we're going to be really, really selective now. And we don't seem to ever find a middle ground, at least it seems to me.
Yeah, and it really does get to broader philosophical questions. Should the government try to identify the kind of people we should allow into our country, or is that hopelessly misguided, and should we just have a more open door policy and let the good people rise to the top? I mean, how do you anticipate who the next, you know, brilliant entrepreneur is going to be, or such? Sometimes the government's not the best judge of the best people. So let the free market for laborers, if you will, operate. So I think there are many policy reasons why immigration benefits our country. Probably the most important one is it keeps our population stable and growing. We're not getting older as fast as countries like Japan or China, which are really going to face a crisis of elderly with not enough young people to support them. I like to think when I'm older and a home help aide is sent to help me in my home and I open the door that, you know, the person's not 90 years old. Right? We need to have young workers, and we're not having enough native-born to do that. The number of children and families continues to decline. So immigration has been a huge benefit for the United States compared to other countries. It keeps our population younger, our workforce stronger, and that benefits us as a country. But that's a policy question. We could decide, no, we don't want that. I just hope that the decision is made based on reasoned principles and not based on demonizing people and mongering fear among the population.
Well, Ed Filone, we could talk for hours about this and still not get it all settled, but it has been such an illuminating conversation, and I want to thank you for stopping by.
It's been my pleasure, Bonnie. Thank you.
Ed Filone is an associate professor at Marquette University Law School and a member of the Undocumented Students Task Force at Marquette. He'll be one of four panelists at a forum on immigration organized by the League of Women Voters of Milwaukee County on Saturday at Alverno College. He spoke with Bonnie North, and you'll find a link to more about the discussion at WUWM.com.